This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. World-famous musician Wynton Marsalis and former Charlotte Mayor Anthony Fox share a dream for Charlotte to be the home of a major jazz festival. The groundwork is being laid, and we hear all about that in the second part of the program today. First, the Beckler Museum of Modern Art's latest exhibition, The House That Modernism Built, showcases pieces, from the 20th century in which the art is functional. Or perhaps we should say where functional pieces are so well designed, they are also considered to be art. The exhibit includes textiles, ceramics, and furniture, and perhaps the most famous pieces are those of designers Charles and Ray Eames. We are fortunate to have their grandchild with us in the first part of the program, director of the Eames Office, filmmaker, author, artist, Eames Dimitrios. Welcome to Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
I'll put a stop to that very quickly.
Right. Promises.
And we're also joined by John Boyer, president and CEO of the Beckler Museum of Modern Art. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you.
And Jen Siddle Edwards, PhD, is the curator of this exhibit at the Beckler. She is also with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. In the mid-20th century, when the objects that you have on display and others were being produced, was it the intent of the people producing those items for them to be art, or was the purpose for them to be utilitarian? I mean, in the case of Charles and Ray Eames, the Eames chair, the famous Eames chair, was it a chair or was it more than a chair?
Well, it was more than a chair, but Charles would have answered your question is by saying, well, do I have to choose between my head and my heart? In other words, why shouldn't it be beautiful and why shouldn't it be functional? And I think that that's the challenge that they put forward to the world and to themselves. And there's some really great examples that the Beckler has curated from our collection and other collections, speaking of the Eames work in particular, that really show that in a very acute way.
Well, I know that the literature surrounding this exhibit talks about how these pieces are timeless and how they blend with various different pieces of art, from contemporary art to earlier pieces of art. But these are pieces of art that were meant not just to hang on a wall. These are pieces of art that people used and continue to use today, because some of these things are still in production. So was that concept, the idea that design could be art, something that was new for the time? Or was it just a continuation of previous thought?
I think that... I'm trying to think of how to answer your question best. I mean, what I did with the show where I was pairing artworks with the objects of design was to show the similarity between the two in the thought process and in the production, so that both artists and designers were approaching making in this similar way, that they were thinking about a problem and then approaching it with this holistic idea of pulling resources and ideas from all over, whether it be philosophy or literature or theology or technology or other art forms. So I think certainly, I mean, as Eames said, a lot of the designers were thinking about the artists who were working around them and surely thought about the aesthetics of their object and so wanted to make a pleasing work that would, I mean, I think everyone wants to make something that will be timeless. Mm-hmm. But really for all of the people in the exhibition, whether they be artists or designers, I think the goal was to solve a problem and do that the best way that they could. And if you got this beautiful aesthetic object out of the result that would be appreciated 100 years later, both to sit on and to look at, that was a bonus.
These objects are part of what has come to be called the modernist movement. Why did it get that name?
Well, a lot of different figures.
Love these questions.
Well, the thing is, it's also a matter of who gives them the name, right?
Right.
I think that the most important artists of any period are immune from that kind of labeling. They have a view of the world and their role in it and what it is they're trying to accomplish for themselves first as creative artists, but in many cases with the implication of the greater good, the big picture, the long term. So whether they're called modernist or not, and you know, by the way, and modernism, when? I mean, Baroque was modern compared to the Renaissance.
Right.
Renaissance was modern compared. So I think that the best of these creative figures, they just don't pay attention to that kind of labeling.
Your grandfather and step grandmother, I guess, they were their pieces, their furniture pieces were part art, they were part design, they were part engineering, they were part science. How did they think of themselves? Because they also got involved. Charles got involved in movie making. So how did he view himself? What did he when he said "I am"? What was the finish to that sentence?
They saw them. They did have a holistic vision of themselves. And Charles would usually try to avoid identifying himself. I think to the extent he did, he would call himself an architect because he saw everything he did through the lens of architecture. And Ray always called herself, thought of herself as a painter. And I think that today, people may not realize what painter meant to a certain generation, probably to painters today. But it's actually a very disciplined thing. And there was a way of looking at the world that she brought. She years later, after Charles died, actually, somebody asked her, "How did it feel, Mrs. Eames, to have given up your painting for design?" And she said, "I never gave up my painting. I just changed my palette."
Wow.
And so I think that that's part of the philosophy and the discipline that Jen was talking about, that they applied to what they did. So when you see they never called themselves artists. They felt that was something that other people could call you, but you didn't call yourself that. But they did think of themselves as tradesmen who happened to use the tools of the arts to accomplish their work.
You mentioned that – I think you just said that Charles saw the world through the lens of architecture. And he worked with the Academy Award-winning filmmaker Billy Wilder. And he said, I'm told by reading, that that he learned more about architecture working on Billy Wilder's films. How so?
What he said is that he learned more about architecture by watching Billy Wilder on the set than from most architects. And the only nuance is that is when you think about a movie, it's a system to create it. And you think about Eames furniture. They're not trying to make one pretty chair. They're trying to make a system that can mean long after they're gone that their chairs can still be in existence. And it's a systems design thing. And I think a lot of people neglect this aspect of the world, frankly, and that's a big part of design. Because for a lot of designers and architects, but especially designers, multiplicity is inherent in design. And I think that's one of the fascinating things when you go to the show. I would say the place that both where the artists and the designers break away from each other, not devastatingly, they're still friends, they'll still have coffee together, but where they separate a little bit is that in the end, the artist is usually trying to make a one-off experience where the designer is usually trying to figure out a way to give that gift to people again and again. And so my grandparents and I called Ray my grandmother, and she thought of herself as my grandmother.
Okay.
So, used to say that the role of the designer is basically that of a good host, anticipating the needs of the guest. And when you live in that world, in that mental space, when you're creating, I think you have a better chance of making things that are timeless.
So when they made the famous Eames chair, and they gave, the very first one to Billy Wilder, it wasn't designed for him, but they gave it to him because
he was a good
friend.
Well done.
Thank you. it's been described, for people who don't know this chair, and I can't imagine people don't know this chair, certainly if you're a certain age, you watch Tom Snyder sit in it every night on the Tomorrow Show.
It was on Frasier, too.
And on Frasier, exactly. It's described as a baseball glove because it's leather, but it also the way it envelops you when you sit in it, it's like the ball sitting in the glove, correct?
I wanted it to feel like a well-used baseball glove.
Uh-huh.
And that's the thing about them, and it even goes back to John's comment about what modernism means in this particular conversation, is that they recognize the value of the passage of time. They believe that they used to say innovate as a last resort, even though you see things in that museum that are pretty darn innovative. It doesn't mean don't innovate. It just means that when you innovate for its own sake, you run the risk of losing little pieces of information that are transmitted colloquially, generationally, however.
So the furniture that's in this exhibit, the pieces that are in this exhibit, other than just the Eames pieces, and the art that you've paired it with, all part of the modernist movement, was it a conscious movement, or was it simply an evolution to the next thing in art and design at the time?
I think building on what John said before, I mean, we sort of impose these terms on movements retroactively. So modern, at the time that it was called modernism, so in the 20th century when people were saying this is modern art, I think at the time they meant more contemporary art. Like this was the stuff that was being made in the present time. And now we call contemporary art being made now, contemporary art. And the art being made in the 20th century and last half of the 19th, modern art.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the similarity that all these artists had during the modern period, like the zeitgeist that was connecting them all, was the fact that everyone was interested in materials and interested in what the industrial processes could do and what natural materials could do and how to weld these two things together.
And part of this is from the period of time in which these people lived and worked.
Exactly.
It was post-World War II. Mm-hmm. We had come out of terribly dark days with the Great Depression and also the World War. And suddenly the world was our oyster, at least in the United States it was our oyster because we were the only operational economy. And they were very optimistic about the future, right? And that is reflected in the work that they did, correct?
Yeah, and I think the utopian ideas that come across in the artists who were featuring in the show – they definitely come out of that, of how to recover from this horrible period of seeing humanity's injustice to the fellow humans. And so, I mean, it's really a very moving aspect, I think, of the exhibition to see these grand gestures to try and make the world a better place, whether it's in the home, Buckminster Fuller's geodesic dome, which he had hoped would provide this incredible resource for people who needed better homes and unique homes. And
let's talk about that.
Yeah.
because you are responsible for erecting essentially a geodesic dome as part of this exhibit.
Yes.
Let's go back to Buckminster Fuller, though.
Sure.
Why did he design these geodesic domes?
I mean, that was one of many efforts that Fuller was doing to try and create housing for, I mean, what he saw as this large population of people who needed homes. I mean, people were moving out of these extended family homes. And also after the Depression, people, you know, it was housing was a real concern. And also, you know, there was not just the Depression, but also the farming crisis and the Dust Bowl. And there were a lot of different reasons why people in the country were suffering from
poor options. So he saw these as what? Inexpensive, easy to build?
Yes. Yeah, it took us 4 hours to erect that dome. It's incredibly sturdy. The tarp that covers it, I think, is actually pretty weather resistant. I mean, being in that dome, I realized why he thought this was a genuinely viable option.
Why didn't they catch on?
Well, I mean, they're very impractical in ways. I mean, it is, you're living in one room. And his Dymaxion house, which you can actually see if you visit the Henry Ford in Dearborn, Michigan. Similarly, it's another house that he thought would be it would just take off because you could kind of erect it like an umbrella. And,
right.
You know, he thought it was going to be the new trend in housing to replace all the little.
But we all know what happens to umbrellas in breezes, right? So.
Yeah. I think these are a little more stable, a little more reliable.
And you're using this dome in the exhibit to showcase
yes.
films that Charles Eames made.
Yes. Yeah. It's also to talk about, though, the North Carolina tradition of modernism, because Buckminster Fuller developed that dome here in North Carolina. He developed it at Black Mountain College in Asheville, North Carolina, over the summers of 1948 and 1949.
And we've done a show on that. That was a remarkable place for its time.
Yeah.
It was all about artists and artisans and very creative work being done up there.
Yeah, so we touch upon that legacy in the exhibition. But then after he left Black Mountain College, Fuller went to teach at NC State University's new School of Design program, which had opened a few years earlier. He brought the original dome, and Murray Wisnant, who's a local architect and designer who went to school there, tells the story of Fuller leaving the original dome in a box in the men's lavatory, and everyone going and paying homage to the box.
That's Jen Sudell Edwards, who's the curator of The House That Modernism Built, which is on exhibit through September 11th at the Bechtel Museum of Modern Art. Also with us, John Boyer and Eames Demetrius. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Cary Fry Interior Design, providing commercial interior design services in the Carolinas, celebrating Sea Level, a new Cary Fry Design restaurant in the Hearst Building uptown. Details at cfidstudio.com. And Davidson College, presenting a lecture by Steve Palioka, co-owner of the Boston Celtics, on basketball business and the changing game, Tuesday, April 26th, 7 p.m. Details at davidson.edu. Well, on the weekly local news roundup, Governor McCrory meets the press on HB2. In reaction to that, a court ruling in Virginia favoring a transgender teen will have implications for North Carolina. Attorney General Roy Cooper moves ahead of Pat McCrory in the race for governor. We get an update on the city budget process, and CMPD says they are not getting what they need to keep up with growth. Our reporter roundtable tackles those stories and more on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, new studies show immunotherapy drugs are effective against a range of cancers and could become a more standard course of treatment. How medications that use the body's own immune system can fight some of the most difficult to treat cancers.
The Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the house that modernism built on display at the Bechtler Museum of Modern Art through September the 11th, and the fact that one of our guests, Eames Demetrius, who's the grandson of Charles and Ray Eames, who designed the famous Eames Furniture Collection, which, by the way, you can still buy it. Some of these pieces. He's speaking tonight at 7 at Wells Fargo Auditorium. Also with us, John Boyer, who is the president and CEO of the Bechtler, and Jen Soodle Edwards, who is the curator of this exhibit, which features over 200 different pieces. How did you get them? Where did you get them from? How did you get people to part with them, even for 6 months?
Oh, my gosh, all over the country. It was actually pretty easy. A lot of people were very excited to have the design objects on display in the museum, and they were excited that we were elevating these works to the level of artworks. So the fact that we were pairing them with these stellar works from our collection and putting them in a museum, people were pretty excited about that. We worked closely as much as we could with the actual artists. Foundation, so Eames in the case of Charles and Ray Eames, and then also the Girard Studio, Alexander Girard, who was a designer in the 20th century. He's a major part of the exhibition as well, and we worked with his grandchildren who run the foundation. Then also the Henry Ford, as I mentioned before. Right. They have an incredible collection of both industrial design and furniture made in the country.
Aside from the famous Eames chair and the Eames chaise?
A chaise lounge.
Aside from those pieces, which we'll talk about, did you have specific pieces in mind that you wanted as part of this, and you had to do a little legwork to find them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Robert Probst was kind of a standout designer for me when I was doing my research. He was a designer who specialized in systems design, and he developed what many of us now curse as the cubicle office. And he was just this fascinating figure. He started off as a beach master when he graduated college, which meant he stood on the top of hills during World War II in the Pacific Theater and analyzed all of the invasions that went on below him. And during this moment of intense carnage and emotional upset, he could still remain very objective because he saw things as systems of patterns. And he realized that an artist was the best person to do this sort of work because artists do see things in this very specific way of patterns. And he went on to make a career out of doing that, of looking at situations and analyzing accordingly. So that was probably the hardest thing to do. I had to go to Herman Miller Archives because they have some of the original pieces Probst designed for the original cubicle office called Action Office 2, and then also the Henry Ford.
This is another thing that's interesting about some of these pieces. You just mentioned Herman Miller. I know that the Eames Furniture Collection, part of it is available still, and it's still being produced by Herman Miller. How did that relationship, and that goes back to your grandfather.
Absolutely.
How did that relationship begin?
Well, it began because somebody told the makers of the Herman Miller Company, who was making colonial reproductions in the late 30s, that wasn't honest. And D.J. Dupree, who was the head of Herman Miller that time, had never been called dishonest in his life because he was a very honest guy.
It was Gilbert Rohde, who we have in the show.
And Gilbert Rohde was the designer who told him that. And it sort of changed his whole attitude because he never thought about that issue. And Gilbert Rohde basically said, you should design for today. You should be producing for today. Hmm. So now you cut till after the war. And and Charles and Ray have designed this furniture and they need a home for it. And there were other manufacturers they were looking at, but what they loved about Herman Miller is that they would sell it as good stuff, as good solutions, not as famous designs, but as good solutions. Even today, when people sometimes look at even some of the chairs in the show and say, they look uncomfortable, I say, please sit in them, not in the show. Don't do it. You'll get in trouble.
Thank you.
You owe me $5. But anyway, but when they to sit in a showroom and actually sit, because they are comfortable.
Yes.
And I always say, never buy these chairs because they're homework. Buy them because they work. And that functionality kind of goes to the heart of how Charles and Ray lasted so long.
There's a cartoon, and I guess it's in the material that I read yesterday.
From the New Yorker.
From the New Yorker, yeah. Where a guy is sitting in an Ames chair with his feet propped up on the ottoman, and he's just incredibly comfortable. And across the room is another person sitting in a piece of Stickley furniture, which is Craftsman and not designed to be terribly comfortable. And the guy in the Stickley furniture says, tomorrow I get the Ames, or the other way around. Tomorrow you get the Stickley and I get the Ames. Today, I went online yesterday because I love the Ames chair. Mm-hmm. It's $4,000.
Well, it's a good point. Yeah.
But wait a minute. My point is you can also go online and get it for $400. It's a knockoff. And I know that's a sticking point for you.
Well, it's not a question of a sticking point. It's you're not getting an Ames chair. You're getting something that looks like an Ames chair.
Okay. And the difference would be what?
Well, for one thing, the chairs that Herman Miller makes are made from the inside out, not the outside in. The main purpose of the chair that the knockoff that you're looking at is to confuse you long enough online to order it. Then, there are even companies that send you a miniature after you order it online because they set it up so that you sign the paperwork before you open it. So the point is that we live in a world where everything is about how it looks. And in fact, I think the design world has some responsibility for it. I mean, I've had a lot of people say to me, I got this coffee maker. It didn't work. It was too designy. And I always think if it didn't work, it wasn't designy enough, right? But design is trying to own the space about being just about the look. And I think that's one thing I think people really take away from this show. Because, you know, you said it was a utopian time, and I actually disagree. The Cold War was starting. We had major things unresolved about civil rights. We had seen how bad things could get. The bomb was here.
Right.
People had seen, you know, people realized that Hiroshima was a lightweight compared to what people were working on now. But I do think what people had was a sense of purpose, was realization that war at its best could force you to be rigorous and learn things about materials and about ways of living and ways of approaching things. And if one could only take that into the peacetime world, one could make the world better. But I think it's really important to recognize that this was not a romantic time. I mean, you know, Patton wanted to just to turn from Berlin to Moscow with the army. I mean, he didn't want to take a breath. You know, and it's not about whether that's the right attitude or not, but that's just what was in the air. So I think it's important to realize that you're not looking at people who are softies. Mm-hmm. It's not that, you know, Buckminster Fuller was being indulged. He was trying to really help people. He was saying, we've done so much in this war. We've learned so much about these materials. Can I help people's lives be better? And most people still wanted a Cape Cod house. Fair enough. But in fact, the geodesic dome is used as lots of applications, ironically, more commercially. Mm.
Mm-hmm. And also in play yards.
Yeah, the chair, and I hate to keep going back to the chair, but the chair is iconic. And part of it is not only its comfort, but the way it looks. And that's part of your challenge with the ripoffs, is that they just make it look like the chair, but it doesn't have the comfort and it doesn't have the durability. And it's not 10 years from now, it's not going to be here anymore.
Exactly.
But that chair is partly iconic because it uses molded wood on the base. And that's something that your father kind of helped pioneer, didn't he?
Well, my
grandfather
a little bit more.
Excuse me.
Yes and no. He did pioneer it, but actually that chair is interesting because it has a simple two-dimensional curve, which their innovation was more the three-dimensional curves.
Okay.
But that said, they were masters of that technique, and in particular using veneers that thin to make the form of that chair. The other interesting thing about that chair is that, you know, you mentioned the thing about the price. I think one of the challenges of our world now is that we've done an analysis of, you know, the rate of inflation, and the chair is actually cheaper
today
by the cost of living than it was then. But the problem is everything else in your home is cheaper and better than it was 50 years ago. Your phone, computer, obviously, oven, refrigerator, TV. I mean, the black and white TV that somebody bought in 1955 costs more as percentage of income than the high-def TV today. And I think that this is one of the things that really has disguised a lot of the pressure that people today feel, in terms they feel pinched, and yet they have all this miraculous technology around them. And furniture is made the same way.
But the other chairs, some of the other chairs that your grandfather and grandmother designed and made were molded plastic. And I think probably everybody in the world has sat in those chairs at some point in their lives in some of the most unassuming places. Oh, I don't know, like tire store waiting rooms.
Absolutely.
I mean,
airports,
they're molded.
Yeah. Stadiums, yeah.
Why did they catch on so quick, so well?
Because they hit the sweet spot. They had a dream of making the best for the most for the least. And when they discovered this material, plastic, that had never been used, plastic reinforced by fiberglass in particular, mm-hmm. they realized its potential to make a beautiful object that worked. And that's the thing, is that I'm so glad you mentioned that they're in, you know, in auto body, you know, waiting rooms or whatever you just said, because I think that that's the thing, is that design is for everybody. And I think that, you know, it's like, you know, think about like race cars. I think there's a little bit of interest in race cars in the city. And, you know, so race cars are $1 million machines. Who wants them? They're for the elite, right? Well, that's not true. You know, airbags, a lot of the seatbelt, all first existed in racing cars. So sometimes these designers who are doing what looks like crazy things are actually doing the most pragmatic thing possible. They're taking us into the next generation.
Well, speaking of pragmatic design, Billy Wilder asked your grandfather for a chaise, and he wanted it to be a certain size and a certain width for a certain reason.
He did, and it's a chaise lounge. And I should just say that Billy really loved to take a cat nap, and he would sit like this, lay like this, and I'm putting my arms over my chest, and after about 10 minutes, he'd fall asleep. But he was a little worried because, you know, directors in Hollywood still have a bad reputation. And so he said, you know, the great thing about this is that nobody could ever accuse it of being a casting couch, unless your girlfriend was a Giacometti. And we happen to have a Giacometti over at the Beckley. Just saying.
Very skinny. But the idea was that because he crossed his arms over his chest.
Yeah, and he really wanted to be able to take these cat naps. And Charles had worked on a film of Billy's where Charles shot the second unit. And they'd both seen in the wilds of Nova Scotia a lighthouse keeper's bench that was very narrow, and they admired it together. That dimension kind of came from that. The shape of it actually came later from
kind of an S.
Yeah, it's kind of a bit of an S. And I remember as a kid, it was so exciting because a huge box came to our house. And because they would send our mom some their furniture from time to time. And it was just so exciting. We opened it. It was like, what is this? And she calls Charles on the phone and gets the whole story. And it's a very comfortable chair.
Yeah. And the idea, well, getting back to the crossed arms, as I understand it at least, is that he only wanted to take short naps.
Absolutely.
So
Built-in alarm clock.
When his arms fell off his body, that would wake him up.
Exactly.
And he was ready to get
and
up.
And that is functional.
And
I think
functional.
One of the beautiful things that it even comes across in the show is that Charles and Ray understood that function, that beauty could be, aesthetics could be a part of function.
Hmm.
And if you think about that, I mean, the example they often used was the telephone, the classic telephone, which none of your listeners under the age of 40 ever dialed on. But it's the one that's in all the old movies. It's the classic phone that Henry Dreyfuss designed. And they said, think about that. It sounds good when you hang it up. Not the ring, but literally material on material.
Yeah, it felt good. Those old phones, they were built to last.
Exactly. And they.
Funny, we have some for the show that we weren't able to include because it was just too complicated to install. But when we do the next iteration of the Greg pieces, they'll be on view in the fall.
So I'm sorry.
I love those phones.
Oh, no. But you said exactly the right things. You have all these intuitive feelings about it. So it looks good. It sounds good. It smells all right when you're on it. It tastes good, but tastes okay when your lips get on it because that happens. So yeah. Charles said, think about all those things. What if you changed them all? It looked bad, sounded bad, smelled bad, tasted bad.
Yeah.
Would you say that phone was more functional or less functional? I certainly hope you'd say it was less functional. And yet all those things are aesthetics. So aesthetics can be part of that, part of the design.
You think that was a mistake with the telephone? Because the telephone, you rented those phones from the phone company. They didn't want to have to replace them ever.
Well,
so they made them to last forever.
And that's a very good thing.
Who else? What other designers? What other objects are a part of this exhibit?
Eero Saarinen is also a big standout. He and Charles actually met at Cranbrook in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. So when you get off the elevator, the first thing you see actually are Eero Saarinen's womb chairs. And he's a significant designer for me in addition to Charles and Ray Eames because he kind of went a kind of different direction. So he has a bunch of stand-up pieces. Gilbert Rohde, as we mentioned before, who brought the idea of modern design to Herman Miller. Florence Knoll, who went on to start Knoll with her husband. We have some great textiles from Knoll as well, which also came out of Cranbrook.
Okay.
Those are some favorite pieces.
Things going well, John, at the Beckler? Because he just mentioned that NASCAR was kind of popular here, and I would beg you to take him down the street to the NASCAR Hall of Fame and let him tour it, because you and he will be the only people there. So,
first of all, was that even a question, Mike? I don't know what to do with any of that.
How are things going at the Beckler?
Well, I think things are going very well for NASCAR, for the Mint, for the Blumenthal, and fortunately for the Beckler too. I mean, I'll tell you this much: that
I kid the NASCAR Hall of Fame.
I know you do. I know you.
You kid because you love.
That's right. But I think that we should all be grateful right now. Charlotte is experiencing happily this remarkable burst of growth in our cultural and historic and artistic lives, and a lot of good things.
John Boyer is president and CEO of the Beckler Museum of Modern Art. Jen Sudel Edwards is the curator of the house that modernism built, on display at the Beckler through September the 11th. And in Eames Demetrius is a guest in our city, filmmaker, artist, director, author. I'll make you anything you want to be. And he speaks tonight at 7 o'clock at the Wells Fargo Auditorium. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having
us.
Thank you, Michael.
Time for a little jazz now. Former Charlotte Mayor, now U.S. Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox, and his friend, world-renowned musician Wynton Marsalis, had a dream for Charlotte, and now that dream is taking shape. They wanted the Queen City to become home to a major jazz festival. The groundwork has been laid, and this week, the Charlotte Jazz Festival is underway under the auspices of Blumenthal Performing Arts. Tom Gabbard, president and CEO of Blumenthal, is producing the festival. He is here in our Spirit Square studio along with Lonnie Davis, president and CEO of Charlotte's Jazz Arts Initiative and of the Jazz Room at the Stage Door Theater. Welcome back to both of you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And we're also joined by Lavelle Bradford, a Charlotte jazz pianist who will be featured this week and has been featured this week during the Jazz Festival at the Levine Center for the Arts, which is home to the Knight Theater. Welcome to you. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. I know we've talked about this before. In fact, Wynton Marsalis talked about this on this program when he was here. But for those who may have missed it, why is he so interested in 60 seconds or less in bringing a jazz festival to this city?
Well, I'll plunge in. He really was interested in finding something that celebrated great jazz, but also engaged the community in a great way, which doesn't happen with most jazz festivals. To put the best of jazz from around the world and the best of local jazz artists on the same stages is a remarkable thing.
And that's what he envisioned, the local and national.
That's what he's envisioned, and it is unusual. Most jazz festivals haven't gone that direction. One example I give of that was New Orleans Jazz Festival last year. The headliner was Elton John.
So not only is it going away from local artists, it's going away from jazz.
Right.
Well, that's something special. We're going to come back and talk more extensively about the Charlotte Jazz Festival, which is now through Saturday at the Levine Center for the Arts at the Knight Theater and outside, inside and outside. We'll talk about all that. We'll meet Lavelle in a second, too. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members in Ashe County, celebrating the arrival of spring and summer with hiking, biking, kayaking, and fishing. Located in the northwest corner of North Carolina, bordering Tennessee and Virginia. Details on Ashe County at thecoolestcorner.com. and ScoopCharlotte.com, providing women in Charlotte daily info on shopping, fitness, dining, and things to do. Presenting The Scoop each week with ScoopCharlotte.com. Harriet Tubman is set to replace Andrew Jackson on the center of a new $20 bill. The first time in more than a century, the front of our paper currency will feature a woman. So, in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, journalist and author Isabel Wilkerson joins Diane with her take on the significance of the change in our currency. That's coming up. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's your shot. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or reach us through Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
Dana Lumsden, managing partner of the Charlotte office of Bradley Arendt Bolt Cummings, a WFAE underwriter.
Not everyone who listens to WFAE may be independently wealthy, but they're definitely well-educated listeners, people that have strong opinions, people who are in leadership positions in their organization. Those are the people that we want to know about us, and that's why WFAE was a perfect fit for us.
Underwriting on WFAE says a lot about your business. To learn more, email underwriting@wfae.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about the Charlotte Jazz Festival. Saxophonist John Ellis and his tune Booker from his album Double Wide Charm, which features another Marsalis, Jason Marsalis, on drums. But what sticks out to me, and this is very New Orleans sounding to me, is it New Orleans? What sticks out to me is that I hear a tuba in that. Is that right?
Yes, you do hear a tuba in that. I love that tune. Yeah.
I mean, that it just gives it a real New Orleans feel. But why a tuba in jazz? I don't think I've ever heard a tuba in jazz.
I think, well, the tuba was the original bass
instrument
in jazz before the acoustic or the contrabass took over. So, yeah, that's very traditional. Yeah,
to me, it sounds very cool.
Now. Yeah.
It's very happening. Lonnie, you've been at this for a while, this jazz game. You came from New Orleans, and you've been working very hard over the last several years with the Blumenthal to reestablish a jazz scene in the city. And you do it through the Stage Door programs, which are what, monthly?
Yes.
Stage Door Theater, which is at the base of the office of the Bank of America Tower, right under the Blumenthal Belk Theater. It's kind of a neat thing because it was designed to be a rehearsal space, and now it's a theater. It's very cool. How's that going?
The Jazz Room is doing outstanding. We just completed our third year at the Jazz Room, and it was a success from the very beginning.
And it seats about 200 people. You're right on top of the musicians, and it's a very intimate space. It's like going to a really nice club.
Yes, it's done so well that we've now started to add Saturday shows and are considering other ways to expand the series, and we're even selling out those.
And you're a Charlotte musician, Lavelle, and I know that you played, I think, yesterday outside of the Levine Center for the Jazz Festival. What's the, from your perspective as a working musician, what's the music scene like here, jazz scene like here?
Oh, wow. God. Bad
Give me
question.
Some time, man. Give me some time. When I first moved to town, first of all, I played jazz and gospel. I knew that I'd have no problem finding gospel guys here in town because Bible Belt is just, you know, the deal. But I was a little leery about what I would find as far as the jazz scene is concerned. I hear that at one time, Charlotte jazz scene was really up and popping.
I heard that, too.
I hear that on many accounts.
Ask me, I'll tell you.
But I guess over the last 5 to 10 years, that scene has diminished, not only with the players, but venues as well.
Is that peculiar to Charlotte or to cities this size, or is that something that's happened all over the country with live music and particularly with jazz?
Well, Charlotte has no excuse not to have a thriving jazz scene. We have venues, we have musicians. Musicians move to town but are discouraged to stay here. And I was telling someone before when we interviewed Lonnie, that there are a lot of musicians, known and unknown, that come to Charlotte with hopes of becoming part of the local jazz community and spend most of their time taking flights out of the city to play gigs
which
elsewhere.
You do.
I do. I do.
And you do that not only because you're asked to, but because you have to.
Because I have to.
You want to eat.
I want to
eat.
It's
a bad habit.
I want
to
eat.
Stop.
I want lights. I want to turn the switch on. But the Jazz Arts Initiative has been great in not only galvanizing the listener, but the musicians and feeling that we have a place here in Charlotte to show our gifts and our skills.
And this takes place inside the Knight Theater and outside on the street where the musical performances are free. Is this kind of like having a loss leader? You want to put things outside to whet people's appetites who may not think that they like jazz, but they walk by it, they stand there, they listen to it, and they think, well, that's pretty good. Maybe I'll buy a ticket.
Yeah, I think really this is the first time when we've seen the Levine Center for the Arts accomplish what we really set out to do in building it, which is to take these museums, to take the theater, to take this outdoor space and really bring it to life in an integrated way. There are concerts in all three of the museums. We've set up this pavilion that has these free concerts, so you don't have to pay anything to participate. You know, we've had free concerts all week. It continues through the weekend, so you don't even have to have a ticket to be a part of the scene. But we were so fortunate to have this Levine Center for the Arts with the three museums and the theater, and so this is really the first time that whole campus has sprung to life in this way.
What was it like? It was a beautiful day yesterday. What was it like playing outdoors?
It was a great day. It was great. I was teasing Lonnie. I was telling the fellas, hey, let's play good so Lonnie next year will book us in the nighttime where all the people come out. And to my surprise, she said, you watch, this place is going to be packed. And there was not an empty seat out there.
Wow.
It was great, great energy, great response.
Well, that's very encouraging because these are people from the office towers, right, who probably don't know a lot about jazz, most of them. Maybe think they don't like jazz. I don't like jazz. And then they hear this, and then you're building an audience. Is that what's going on here, you think? You hope?
I believe that's exactly what's going on, not only with our monthly programs, but certainly in occasions like yesterday. And not only did the workers from the towers come down to have their lunch at the plaza, but I spoke with many people who drove down to be a part of the free activities that were taking place this week and that are taking place. They're coming and finding okay. parking spaces just to enjoy the great music this week.
Now, last year, you and the Blumenthal hosted the Classic Jazz Festival. This year, it's just the Charlotte Jazz Festival. Was that a stepping off point? Is there a marked difference between what happened last year on these stages and what's happening this year musically on these stages?
This is dramatically expanded, and we've been working quietly to kind of lay the foundation for this. This is a big initiative to launch a festival this size. So we've taken a few years to plant the seeds. Winton and Jazz at Lincoln Center have been here twice. Last year ramped up a few things, particularly launching the Lunis McGlowan Student Jazz Award. That's a very big deal. And that was launched last year. Now it's ramped up. Some very big scholarships that go along with that.
Lunis McGlowan, for people who do not know, was a friend of mine. We worked together at WBTV. He was the music director at BTV for years and is a far better known outside of Charlotte than he is here. He was a composer and a lyricist and a jazz pianist who was just wonderful. And the fact that his name is on the theater down the hall is a testimony of how important he was musically. I mean, he would walk into a jazz club in New York, and people on the stage would see him, and they'd start playing Blackberry Winter or one of the other songs that he wrote because he was Lunis McGlowan, and he was here like Frank Sinatra. Do people know, do the young people coming into this Lunis McGlowan competition know who he was?
I would guess not. But I think through this process,
they will learn.
Yeah. And that's a beautiful thing for them to understand the heritage and that this award lifts him up and provides that recognition that he deserves.
It's really special. And I want to thank you as a friend of his for putting his name on that. You're from New Orleans, Lonnie.
Yes, I am.
It's the cradle of jazz. And you're bringing something to this festival that is particularly New Orleanian, if that's how you say it. And for those who have never watched HBO's Treme or who never have been to New Orleans, tell us what a second line is.
Oh, wow. Well, a second line starts, it's really that the roots are from a jazz funeral. And so traditionally, New Orleanians bury their family members and their loved ones. And the band is called the First Line. And they're in front. And then the family.
And they're playing the mournful.
Yeah, they're playing the dirge, the really slow, somber music. And they're kind of marching slowly with their heads down to the burial site. And the family is considered, and all of the, you know, supporters are the called the second line. And so when they, you know, put the body down, or in New Orleans, we say they turn the body loose. So as soon as they turn the body loose, it becomes a celebration. And so that slow mood turns into a very festive celebration of that person's life. And the parade takes off down the street, and it's just a great celebration. And folks that they don't even know who just died. Yeah. They come out of their houses and they join it. And it's a lot of fun.
You have you're bringing a second line.
Yes, we are.
To Charlotte, and you're doing a second line parade down Tryon Street. Let's get a little taste of that second line group that you're bringing. Are you bringing Preservation Hall here?
No, we're not actually bringing Preservation Hall. We are bringing a very legendary Grand Marshal to lead the second line parade. And so that's a very, you know, that's an experience that he's never had.
Well, we'll talk about him in a second, but let's hear a little bit of the kind of music that a second line musical group would be involved in. This is that's Preservation right. Hall playing a song called Lil' Liza. One happy funeral.
That's how we do it in New Orleans.
So you're bringing a Grand Marshal to the festival. Now, is the Grand Marshal part of a second line, or is he more part of Mardi Gras and the individual groups that make up Mardi Gras floats and presentations?
I think there are two types of Grand Marshals, but the type that we're bringing in is specifically for second line. And there are a number of grand marshals. That's all they do in New Orleans. They're not musicians. They don't do anything else but lead second line parades. And they do that for years. This guy, he's 70 years old, but watch his moves.
If you watched Treme, did you watch Treme?
Yes.
On HBO?
Yes.
Wasn't there a character about who was a grand marshal in these second lines? Or
yes, and
they dedicate their lives to this. I mean, they're making costumes and the most incredible. They could be Broadway costumes.
yes. And those are the Mardi Gras Indians. I think you're talking about. But yeah, grand marshals also dress very sharp.
Uh-huh.
And they lead the band, and they're really the flash, you know, of the second line parade, and they kind of lead the way through the street and kind of make room for everyone behind them.
So, Lavelle, where are you from originally?
Originally from Gary, Indiana.
So what's it like there musically?
Well, Gary, Indiana is 30 minutes from Chicago, so they get some of the leftovers.
Or they can get in the car and drive.
Or they can get in the car and drive.
I know you've worked with Lonnie, but as Lonnie puts these together and as Tom and Lonnie work together to put this festival together, which is fairly unique, what are you seeing happening? Are you seeing anything happening? Is this something that you see the potential for growth? Because we're going to be exposed now to New Orleans jazz. We're going to be exposed to Wynton Marsalis, who has been here several times.
Yeah.
There are groups like yours who are playing in this. Are we hearing all the whole panoply of jazz?
Oh, it's just a world of excitement. World of excitement. Everybody's so excited about what's going on. Fellow musicians and listeners as well. All I hear is, man, I'm so excited.
I wanted to get a piano here this morning for you, but unfortunately,
that'd be nice.
That was a challenge and we couldn't do it. So describe your music. What do you play?
Well, my beginnings are rooted in gospel, so I like to express that in the music, nice rhythmic, bluesy type of music that's very emotional and expressive. So, yeah.
And you're playing again. You played yesterday, but you're playing again on what, Saturday night?
Is playing that right? Two times on Saturday. Saturday at 2 and then with Larry Drawn, and then Saturday night with Brian Miller.
Hmm. Jazz Bakery.
Now, Wynton Marsalis, as we've said, this is kind of his idea along with Anthony Fox a long time ago. And we've had him on the program. We talked about this. People who don't know Wynton Marsalis, I was incredibly surprised to find out what a deep thinker he is. Oh, my gosh. One of the smartest people I've ever talked to. I mean, and thinks about things that on such a deep level.
Very profound.
Yeah. Very profound. He's coming back with the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra, correct?
Correct. Yeah, and not only doing concerts, tonight he'll sit in as part of the concert, but Wynton is also doing jazz clinics and is
with young people.
So and that community connection, he is deeply committed to it, and if we didn't have that community connection, he wouldn't be here because he believes so strongly in that.
Wynton Marsalis, at the very beginning of the conversations about starting a jazz festival in Charlotte, said that one of the key ingredients is time for development and patient leadership. You seem, Lonnie, to be that patient leader, and for any leader, patience can be excruciating. As someone who came from New Orleans, where are you on the impatience scale?
I'm actually very patient because I've seen so much growth and development, and I hear the desire for more. And I think we're really in a good place, and movement is taking place. There's momentum around.
And where are you on the development scale with this attempt to make Charlotte a host city for a major festival?
Well, we're at this point, I think we're sold out on at least three, maybe four concerts. So we are off to a great, great start.
So check BlumenthalArts.org because this goes through the weekend, and there are all kinds of free events that the schedule is up on the website for. Tom Gabbert is president and CEO of Blumenthal Arts. Lonnie Davis is president and CEO of the Charlotte Jazz Initiative. And Lavelle Bradford, you can see him tomorrow, or Saturday rather, at the Jazz Festival. Thank you all.